The purpose of an invention may be very far from what it's used for. For example, a cutler may make a fine knife, which can be used by a surgeon to save life, or it may be used by a murderer to kill somebody.
All inventions are amoral in that
sense. They are amoral inherently, yes. And their use doesn't depend on the individual who conceives them.
And I don't think that you can do any subtraction of harm.
This is a program we call Conversation. It's dedicated to the art of good talk. Clifton Fadiman is our host. His guests tonight are Dr. Alfred N. Goldsmith, one of the world's most distinguished inventors in the field of radio, television, and color television, and consultant to major enterprises in that field. Fred Allen, whose widely acclaimed book, Treadmill to Oblivion, has just been published. And Jacques Barzin, historian and author. This transcribed conversation started several minutes ago, and as we turn up our microphones, our conversationalists are deliberating the question, what inventions have benefited mankind the most? Clifton Fadiman is speaking. Let's join them.
Determining the benefits of invention seems to me a kind of a thorny one. Every time I think of any invention that is, you know, magnificent and unusual and all that sort of thing, I find myself questioning its use. For example, the automobile. We couldn't get along without it, we say. And therefore, we assume that it's a benefit to us. That is because it's become necessary. But isn't that a kind of vicious circle of reasoning? Just because we've worked ourselves into a situation where we need the automobile, we say to ourselves it's a great invention.
To be sure, but there's the bare complexity and wonder of it that we must still pay attention to.
Oh, you're talking like an artist now.
Well, something like that. The airplane, the radio tube, the automobile are things that you don't find among the beavers.
We don't know yet. We haven't. The beavers are not represented here.
How about the wheel?
Would you say, Dr. Oldsmith, the wheel was the perhaps the most important fundamental early invention?
Probably the most important, because it was the basis of everything that came later in transportation. Certainly, up to that time, man had two spokes, namely his legs, and he could walk rather slowly. Then he suddenly had 20 spokes and could roll along, so the wheel was a great invention.
Okay, I think your description is absolutely accurate. All you have to prove to me is that it's a better thing for man to move around fast than to move around slow.
Well, think of the evils of log rolling.
Well, if he wants to get out of the way of something that's after him, it's certainly desirable to be elsewhere.
Yes, this you're using it just as a means of survival, in
of
other
survival,
words.
Certainly. And I think you're getting now close to the purpose of invention when you deal with benefits. Inventions may be either to help transportation, to assist communication, and above all, to enable you to lead a more comfortable and lazy life. That means entertainment and relaxation.
Yes, but we've been hung up on this business of wanting to lead a lazy life. The multiplying of inventions is what keeps us from having a moment's rest nowadays. And it's all in pursuit of laziness.
I don't like to commit myself on that.
What about, the doctor mentioned the wheel here, what about fire?
Well, what about fire? You in
favor? Well, fire made favorable, made available many foods that weren't edible prior to the time that they were exposed to fire.
That's true.
I wonder if it's strictly an invention. I don't want to quibble, but isn't the likelihood that it was discovered by accident?
You mean lightning or the like?
Yes, lightning.
Well, you had to find it. Well, yes, but later on to make artificial fire, you had to invent something, didn't you?
Yeah, that's very true.
The match, you had to invent
matches,
something.
Sure. Rubbing
yes.
wood.
And yes. What about pottery to keep food in before there was any... If you had any food, you had to carry it around with you or share it with the animals who were available in your proximity.
I gather, Fred, you think that the inventions which enable us to eat better are among the most fundamental...
Well, I don't think we would have survived had we not been able to eat or to...
To eat everything.
Yeah, practically.
Well, then you bring in the bow and arrow as a great invention, not only of offense, as we can realize, because it was the ancestor of all other forms of missiles... guided and otherwise, but it also enabled us to go out and get food of various varieties. You never would have caught birds on the wing without a bow and arrow.
That couldn't be true, Dr. Goldsmith, but at the same time, that invention is also the progenitor of a whole series of lethal death-dealing devices which we've used on ourselves.
Yes, we'll have to neglect that aspect, else we'll never find anything beneficial. Remember, we agreed, I think, before, that you never could charge the inventor with moral responsibility for the use of the invention.
No, I'll buy that. You can't blame him. All I'm trying to find out is whether, on balance, invention A or B or C does us more good than not. I think it's very hard to answer the question.
Do you think the automobile has destroyed a small-town life, actually?
But yet the fact is, Fred, that we would never want to do without the automobile. If we had a choice, if we went to the polls tomorrow to vote pro or con on the automobile, we would vote pro, wouldn't we?
Hey, you know, you brought up a very interesting point, though, namely whether the benefit of, whether the benefit of the invention should not be judged by a polling system. Ask the public, put before them the dread alternative. Are you ready to give this up or not? Do you think it's beneficial on the whole or not? If the answer is yes, we'll regard it as beneficial, and I suppose that's the only final criterion.
That's an interesting idea. What do you think people would do about atomic fission in that case, Dr. Goldsmith?
Well, today they'd vote no, but they'd probably turn thumbs down, I should say, because they're too frightened. But if there should be general atomic disarmament, and if we'll have power plants all over the world available even in the Arctic zones in the center of deserts, run by atomic power, you carry a few pounds of uranium with you and run the plant for 10 years.
That sounds good.
At that point, I think people would vote yes, so that perhaps the stage of human advancement determines the decision.
Yes, you said people nowadays are too frightened. You don't mean too much. You mean they're frightened just enough.
Oh, yes, they're very properly frightened.
Properly,
very
yes, I wanted to be clear on that.
Dr. Goldsmith, every time there has been a new death-dealing invention, certainly from the time of gunpowder on, hasn't there been the same fright sweeping the world?
Exactly.
Well, then why aren't we equipped better? Now, we're going around with these old biblical bodies with the two eyes and the one mouth, and we're being confronted with nuclear fission and airplanes and automobiles, and we're not equipped. We should have eight legs to get out of the way of the automobile, and we should have nine eyes to see the planes coming. We should have other equipment.
Of course, we're impressed by numbers in a way that's probably not reasonable. We think that if a weapon kills 100,000 people at a time, it's far worse than a weapon that kills one person.
You know,
but it really isn't.
It isn't? Well, now, Jacques, that's the most encouraging thing I've heard in a long time. Tell me why it isn't.
Well, because, in the first place, death occurs to only one person at a time and for him. And, in the second place, if there is evil or tragedy or whatever it is in that death, it is the same whether one suffers or 100,000.
Well, I think we have enough mass production without putting it into death.
Well, I agree with you. I'm not in favor of it. But I'm saying that, take it in another realm. If a railroad accident kills three people, we say, oh, that's a good one. Mm-hmm. If it kills 30, it begins to be alarming, and at 300, we're shocked. But those three people who were killed are just as valuable
as
certainly just as dead as the
others. Yes, but the logic of that reasoning, Jack, leads to the notion that if we should decide to blow ourselves up completely with atomic fission, that would be equally okay.
No, I'm not saying that any of it is okay, but I'm saying that to get alarmed when it gets so large that it might reach you is a little bit fishy.
I wanted to get into a couple of more inventions that you...
Well, there used to be an older thing in vaudeville years ago that the man who invented interest was no slouch. That's funny. What about preserving foods in tins?
What about
preservation of food? Well, I read someplace long ago that if Napoleon had had the food preserved and we have today, that if he could have supplied his army with food, that he would have conquered the world.
But even in Russia, where he had automatic refrigeration, it didn't work.
Well, he didn't have the food with him. He had the refrigeration
and not the food.
It was just the army that got refrigerated, Mr. Barzin, and
that's
not the
right
food, I fear.
That was the starting of the Bebop. That was the coolest army in the... coolest group of people.
Well, now you're very close to air conditioning, which certainly is a great invention.
Oh, do you really think so?
Well, it's the first time that Mark Twain's objection to nobody doing anything about the weather has been overcome.
Well, maybe so, but the weather is still there outside, and when you leave, your air conditioning...
Oh, momentarily. We'll air condition the cities with plastic domes one of these days.
Will you really, Dr. Goldstein?
I doubt it very much.
I was going to ask
I'll want a plastic dome at that time.
Every one of these modern inventions that you've been speaking of, Dr. Goldsmith, at the same time that it gives us a certain comfort and a certain pleasure, also takes away from us another kind of experience. I think that's what Mr. Barzin must have been meaning. It is true that we have air-conditioned homes, and gosh, they sure are convenient. But at the same time, we have become less and less aware and sensitive to changes of weather and climate. Well, changes of weather are kind of interesting. They have their own pleasure, too.
And we become vulnerable to the breakdown. When the slightest thing goes wrong, we're panicked.
That's right.
Well, isn't there a point in the development of invention, a point reached in which actually technical progress imperils mankind, Dr. Goldsmith?
I think
as you said.
You're getting very close, though, now to another fundamental, namely, is there a survival value to comfort, freedom from danger, security, and the like? Or is it better to be pugnacious, in danger, to fight, to have perils, and occasionally to get into real trouble?
You couldn't have put it better, and the answer to that also determines the answer to the question, what inventions are beneficial to mankind?
Yes, you mean in the long run or the short run? Convenience, of course, is given by many inventions. Whether they help people in the long run is another story. It's like any form of crutch.
Well, Dr. Goldsmith, you are a distinguished professional inventor. Do you, when you work out some new gadget, ever think, is this going to be good for people in the long run, or are you simply interested in your work?
Not on the specific invention. In the field in which I work, I've made an original decision that the field is one that's generally interesting, helpful, and is accepted by mankind in general as worthwhile having.
Mass communication.
Then, mass communication, or motion pictures, or color television, or whatever it may be. Now, when it comes to the particular device, I'm content to take the broad classification, not worry any further, and just make the particular invention.
Well, are you sometimes surprised and astonished at the consequences of what you have done?
Very much so. Very much so.
You regret the consequences?
No. On the average, I can say the consequences have been more beneficial than otherwise.
You're pretty well committed, then, to the general notion that mass communication on the whole is a good thing rather than
an excellent thing. I would put it this way. If you can imagine a man who is deaf, dumb, first colorblind, and then completely blind, he'd be a rather unhappy creature. If you could give him hearing that extended beyond the horizon, and then vision, and then remove his colorblindness, I think you would have done something for him. You would have expanded his range of sensation, of possible accomplishment, of accumulation of wisdom in the long run. And consequently, I have little doubt that communication, both mass communication and individual communication, in the long run, is a very good thing indeed. It is beneficial.
Seems cogent enough to me. Got any ideas on that, Fred?
No, I haven't. I just feel sorry for many of the inventors who invent things that come a cropper. Now, there's a book here that I bought some time ago called Patent Applied For, and they have some weird inventions here. One is a lightning conductor umbrella, which I imagine years ago was sure to kill the
purchaser.
No, it's grounded here. You can see a picture of it. The man has the lightning rod on the umbrella, and he's grounded with this wire trailing along behind him.
Yeah, that's a nice thing.
And here's a pocket umbrella that secure in a hurricane, it says here. Probably wouldn't have survived through Hazley. Now, this has come back here. It's in this sun umbrella that they use for golfers now.
I've never seen those.
Yes, they have them over in Knox, I think.
It improves their sunstroke.
Yes.
You know, the question arose before, Mr. Allen. You were talking about how can you tell whether an invention is good or bad. There are only two ways. There are some inventions that are simply wrong. They just won't work or they won't have any usefulness. There are other inventions that are very right, can have usefulness, but they don't have it anyhow because they happen to be off the evolutionary line. Mm-hmm. It's a funny thing. There's a certain problem facing mankind. There'll be two groups of inventors. One group will think up wrong solutions that don't work. They, of course, go into the discard. There'll be a second group of inventors, and they will think up a half a dozen or a dozen or 100 solutions that would work because they were right, too, only They weren't smiled on by Lady Fortune.
But there's a revival possible, too, as in works of art, isn't there, Dr. Goldsmith?
Yes, yeah, long after they're dead.
Often, yes. Isn't it true that the various cellulose and other products of that sort waited 30 years to be developed?
Well, as a matter of fact, most inventions, from the time that you get the red-hot new idea to the time that you've pretty well thought it out is years. From the time that you've convinced the doubting Thomases that it works is more years. From the time that you've convinced the public or a reasonable segment of the public that it works is some more years. So that you run into decades, and in any case, before the thing is generally accepted.
In general, because now we're used to the new thing. Our grandfathers
were
very very conservative, and we're likely to be very radical. We want the latest gadget, even if it's quite useless, like, say, the automatic windows on cars, which I think are a menace, because when the thing goes wrong, you're rained on and frozen, and a simple crank would be worth its weight in rubies.
Doesn't that suggest, what Mr. Barson's been saying, doesn't that suggest, Dr. Goldsmith, there's a sort of law of optimum improvement in inventions, that when you get past a certain point of perfection, the thing begins to go wrong on you?
That's right. You can go to a degree of complexity that's hopeless. Now, we find, for example, that in certain military devices, we multiply vacuum tubes, circuits, and contraptions until, let us say, in Obama, the pilot goes along for the ride, but he has very little to do. Now, this is fine, except that one of these little contraptions can go wrong, and then Obama, the mission, and even the country may be seriously
damaged. But, Dr. Goldsmith, when that happens, don't the inventors get busy on figuring out some new relay switch which will begin to operate if that thing goes wrong?
Then they start on a reliability campaign, which is based partly on simplification and partly on more reliable components and arrangements. But there is, as you say, actually an optimum point. If you go beyond a certain complexity, you run into diminishing returns.
Well, do the inventors know what this point is, or is it a sort of a hit and miss?
Well, they start out with simple devices, then more complex devices, and then they become intoxicated by the exuberance of their own techniques and develop things that are far too complex. And then there are protests from the users, and the device is simplified and brought back into the realm of common sense.
Is it true that there's an accelerated rate of invention in our own time, that with every decade that passes, I'm just thinking of all those funny things that Fred brought up, that with every decade that passes, the rate of invention is increasing?
It is, yes.
At an astonishing proportion.
It is. There's no question about it. If you judge particularly by the number of patents issued per year, the rate of invention is increasing alarmingly. But, of course, many of these patents are quite minor in their scope and don't have any major human significance.
Yes, but a great many are major, too, Dr. Goldsmith.
Oh, yes. I would say that with the growth, with the increase in scientific knowledge and the increase in our technological development, that inventions have become much more common, are made by more people, that the creative instinct in people has been stimulated by the age.
Yes, and yet there are so many simple things that one would think easily within the reach of the inventive genius that keep on being unsatisfactory. I think of little things like in the kitchen, all sorts of things that are clumsy to handle or that won't stay up on their own feet. It's incredible the lack of design and imagination in many of the things we're surrounded by.
Well, most women complain that household appliances are clearly designed by men who know nothing about households. And that may well be true.
Dr. Goldsmith, what sort of fantastic, or perhaps not fantastic, inventions may we expect in the immediate future, do you think? I don't want you to give away any trade secrets. But, for example, a lot of people talking now about the possibility of moving sidewalks as a radical means of solving the traffic problem in large cities. You mentioned before putting cities under a kind of bell, like mushrooms, and air conditioning the whole city. Are these science fiction, or are they in the realm of possibility?
City under a dome, of course, is largely science fiction, because the dimensions, cost, and operating difficulties of such a thing would be very serious. But moving streets, moving pavements, for certain purposes might be quite useful. I understand that actually they're going to put such a thing under 42nd Street to replace the
shuttle
trains.
Right.
Yes,
that's
and years ago there was a proposition by one of the major electric companies for to replace subways by a series of parallel moving platforms.
Any replacement for subways is okay here.
Well, you see, you stepped on from a stationary platform anywhere along the line onto a first moving platform that was going, say, 3 miles an hour. And from that to the next, it was going 6, 9, 12, and finally, on the 15-mile-an-hour platform, you found, theoretically found, seats in which you could sit, be comfortable, and then when you got close to where you wanted to get off, you got off and walked across these things, slowing down until you stepped off on the stationary platform.
Well, you know, that makes transportation and travel a real adventure again.
What about jet trousers?
Well, there is a sporting interest both in jet trousers and in multiple platforms.
I don't even know what jet trousers are, Fred. What are jet trousers?
Well, you they rent you these trousers at 72nd Street, and you put them on, you'd be at Coney Island before you know it. You don't have to bother with the doctor's platform.
I want to get back to the what we may expect in the realm of the future.
Well, if you want to go to the communications field, of course, you can go direct to the dream of... person-to-person communication anywhere. Tesla expressed that back in the 1880s. He said the time would come when everybody would carry, presumably in his vest pocket, a little communication set of some sort, which responded only to his personal signal, much the way a telephone...
Is that theoretically possible?
Oh, yes. And he said that when that time came, if you wanted to talk to your friend... You would call him on this device, and from the depths of a mine or the center of an ocean or the midst of a desert or the streets of a crowded city, you would hear his voice answering. Then he ended very dramatically, and if you didn't hear him answer, you would know he was dead.
Oh, that doesn't follow. He may not want to.
Well, he assumed that this thing would ring so violently that he would answer finally.
Well, then it's not an... improvement.
Dr.
Goldsmith, that's appalling.
This is a very
like
dismal picture
yes,
that you
yes.
draw. That means that I, in this future paradise of yours, am at the mercy of about 3.5 billion people who
that's
may
right.
want to phone.
Not only, can
your
they,
friends are
can
not.
I'm busy.
Not only can they call you and demand an answer, but still worse in this quasi-paradise, they could even turn on their television attachment and see you at any hour of day or night.
Whatever you were doing. Kate.
Yeah, I think we'd better not go into that.
Better reform.
Yes, or declare this moratorium that Fred suggested.
That's the thing to do.
I was waiting, Mr. Allen, to tell us what he thinks about this idea of universal portable television audio communication.
Well, I think we're worse off because today you can escape from the telephone. You can get out of the house. But if you've got the bell tied on you or built in you or growing in you or something that you're...
In your pocket.
In your pocket.
I've often been tormented by a nightmare, Dr. Goldsmith, of a future in which we have invented... we have really perfected mass communication to the degree that it will be possible to bind together in one great instantaneous network all the human beings of the Earth. And that by a system of translation machines such as we have up at the United Nations, they'll all be able to understand anything that's being said. And they're all tuned in at one moment to listen to a central message. And here are billions of people all listening. And the nightmare is very simple. What are they going to hear? Who's going to say something worth
like
all of this?
This sounds like George Orwell's 1984, only on a worse scale.
Well, yes, well, maybe here I can introduce a hopeful note to take care of Mr. Fadiman's trouble. As one who's been teaching too many years, I can tell you that no matter what you announce to whatever group of people, there will be more than half of them not listening.
So they, you mean they'll lower their eyelids?
Yes,
that's
exactly.
That's consoling.
And the other half probably won't get it quite straight. So the pleasant diversity, which I think is what you're aiming at, will continue.
Well, I'm all for the multiplication of mass impressions. Don't misunderstand me. I just think that at the same time, we ought to be trying to work out better and better things to say, as well as better and better ways of saying
Well,
them,
let me go
all.
Back to the benefit situation. I've often heard it said, and if I can pose this question, that if only we had universal communication so that our nation could speak to nation, there would be a great deal more peace on Earth, or less war, at any rate. I wonder if you gentlemen agree with that.
You remember what Bernard Shaw said, that England and America have always been divided by a common language. It may be that understanding each other too instantaneously is a bad thing. Maybe there should be some bars to transmission.
You mean the family quarrels?
Well, so, well, I often wonder whether it would have been a very good thing for the Sermon on the Mount, for example, to have been delivered, say, on all the four networks to millions of people. Perhaps it was better that its profound and message should have filtered down through thousands of years and been understood in various ways by different people. Perhaps a greater richness comes because of barriers to the transmission of an idea. And a reasonable number of barriers.
And you feel that the poignant personal appeal would have been lost by mass presentation.
Well, I think it might have. It's
a commercial would have interfered. It would have been cut off at the end or something because of the commercial.
There's more to it even than that, though. We have today books, magazines, newspapers, radio, motion pictures, and television, probably other media of large-scale communication. Now, if you take the total creative genius of the world, or of this country, in music, literature, and art, and divide it by the number of media and the number of outlets in the media, you find that you're getting a pretty small quantity after the division. So that it isn't that there's probably that there's any less creativeness than there ever was. There's probably a great deal more in some respects. Mm. But it's simply that the demands for its use are so large, mass production, if you please, yes, that everything gets a little thin.
And it's streamlined. It is made to conform to pre-existing formulas.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. We were talking about inventions, and I think there's a type of which I can think of only one example at the moment, which, while meeting a particular need, really slows up and interferes with a desirable result. For example, I think that recently it was announced in that same column that Mr. Allen is reading there that Dr. Lin Yutang had invented a Chinese typewriter after many others had tried and failed. Well, let's imagine that that catches on and that China and all Chinese-speaking peoples use it. Mm-hmm. Will it not stop the trend, which I think is predictable, towards one alphabet and possibly one language for the whole world?
Well, what you're saying, Mr. Barson, seems to be this, that inventions are so unpredictable, they are so unyoked together, that you can't tell whether invention A may not neutralize invention B.
Yes, and there must be many other cases of that than the one I've mentioned.
But I'm all for that. I think that the theory of free enterprise should work out in the field of invention as in any other. In other words, I don't think you can harness or plan inventions so that they will all conduce to a given evolution. Do you think so, Dr. Goldsmith?
I don't think you can. There's always a competition between inventions for time, attention, and adoption. You were mentioning something.
You've been listening to Conversation.